And you all, we will dismiss our kids through for children's worship. We dismiss all the way up through fifth grade if you're new with us. They go out and they worship together in a manner a little bit more fitting for them. Let me move this and not drop my water. Like I said earlier, we're going to be continuing in our study of the book of Romans in Romans 8. We're going to look at the same exact passage we looked at 2 weeks ago, Romans 8, 19 to 25, and we are going to be combing through this pattern of redemption. And so I welcome you to look back there, because we're going to take this pattern and now apply it to specific areas of our lives. That what we see here is not just good theological knowledge. It is actually a way to view life and interpret life and to see God at work in life. So starting in verse 19 of Romans 8, I welcome you to follow along as I read. Is that up? Maybe not. Okay. For the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation has been groaning together in the pains of childbirth until now. And not only the creation, but we ourselves, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for adoption as sons, the redemption of our bodies. For in this hope we were saved. Now hope that is seen is not hope. For who hopes for what he sees? But if we hope for what we do not see, we wait for it with patience. So let's pray. Jesus, would you grant us eyes to see as you see? God, would you give us the freedom to walk where you walk? God, would you give us the boldness to maybe even push against what our culture says, push against what our heart leads us towards, and surrender ourselves to your word. God, I pray that you would speak mightily to us this morning. Give us eyes to see what you're doing, and I pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen. Over this last weekend, Linda came down at my mom's house, and she's like, "Something is wrong with my eyes." And, I'm going to need new contacts. And she's squinting all over the place, and she can't see. And she's like, she feels like her eyes are all getting scratched. Her eyes are hurting. She can't see all this stuff up. And she goes, and she goes back upstairs to try to fix it. And then she realized she put my contacts in. And she had the wrong lenses. And so she wasn't battling anything real in like a life situation or, like something that was real or wrong. She had the wrong lenses. And by having the wrong lenses, she had no grid by which to really see reality. Her struggle was against the lens that she had in her eyes, not against any real struggle in life. I think as God's people, we are in the same exact place, because we tend to view life through a grid that God has not given us. It's as if we put the wrong contacts in, and we're struggling through to see life and to struggle through seeing things as God sees them. Why? Because we have the wrong lenses in, more so than the reality of what we are struggling to understand. And I think what Paul does here in Romans chapter 8 is he gives us a grid to interpret life according to. He gives us the right lenses to view and see life. Because you're going to be bombarded and are bombarded on a daily basis with all sorts of ways to interpret this world. And I think the only right way to interpret the world is according to how God has worked and how God has created and how God works in the midst of a fallen, broken creation. Any other lens is going to lead you to frustration, because it doesn't see the world as God sees it. And so really, that's what we see in Romans chapter 8. And so we're really asking that God would give us all right, so we're not going to be up there. Just follow along. There's an outline in your bulletin, and we're going to go thumbs down on PowerPoint. And so have at it. So we are actually asking God to give us eyes to see, a new way to see life. And remember, last time we looked at creation, fall, redemption, and fulfillment. that was the move of the biblical story that God creates. Soon, two chapters in, this world and this great creation starts to break horrifically. And then God, even in that same chapter, starts to promise redemption. And comes in the person of Jesus and then is ultimately tracking towards ultimate fulfillment or consummation of that biblical story. That is the grid by which we ought to interpret life. And so there's this sense where creation leads to us enjoying God. But the fall happens or sin enters the world. Things start to break and there's this groaning and ache over the things of this world. But then Jesus shows up on the scene and God promises to restore. And so we find ourselves, yes, groaning, but yet longing for that restoration process. And we see seeds of it, beginnings of it. And then we are longing for the day when everything will be set right. When there will be no more pain, no more crying, no more death, no more tears. That we long for that day, but yet we see evidence of it today. And I think that gives us a lens by which we can interpret life. And we're going to start to apply that against life and in specific areas of life. So that groaning aspect really is that learning to be honest. Remember that? The let's look at life for what it is. Let's not candy coat it. Let's not pretend. Let's look at it for the reality of what it is. Resist numbing ourselves to the pain. And we learn to grieve over the broken things of this world. That is a biblical move of faith. But in that, then we find ourselves longing and eagerly waiting for God to work or for us to see him. And then the fulfillment of a living hope, that glory of the one day when everything will be set right. So how does this give us right perspective in life? Is that first, it starts to counteract against the things in the typical way that we think. So this counteracts the way that we typically think in that I think people naturally deny the reality of this world. I think there's a grip of denial for all of us. That the denial is a much easier conclusion than things are really, really broken. If I just kind of deny that things are really broken and I can kind of pretend, then I can kind of float through life and things are better than they, I feel like they're better than they are, and that helps me through. But denial does something. Denial kills spiritual health and spiritual vibrancy because it's not a move of the gospel. It's a move of untruth. And so numbing the pain helps you survive, but you'll never see restoration. Scotty Smith, a former pastor of a church in Nashville, he puts out a blog, and he was blogging about this particular passage, Romans 8, 22 to 24, and he wrote a prayer of his that he was praying for himself and his congregation, his people. He says, "Dear Lord Jesus, thank you that the Christian life is not a call to posing or to pretending, numbing or medicating, but a life of groaning and growing in grace." Paul's words in this passage above are about the intense groans of childbirth help us voice the things that we often feel, living as broken people in a broken world, aching for life in the new heaven and the new earth, that time when all things will be set right. Though you did not give us an epidural or anesthesia, you did give us yourself, and that is enough. And that's the life of the Christian walk. That's what Paul's articulating. It's not as if we deny the broken things and pretend that they don't exist. It's not as if we say, this doesn't hurt me and it's fine, I'm just going to get through it as God's people. It's no, we look deeply at it. We learn to grieve and groan and ache and then long for Jesus to show up and heal and restore. And so the grip of denial kills spiritual health. So if you are one that tends towards denying broken things, know that that is not the path of the gospel. Because also our culture is telling us some things. So not just our own heart of deny, but our culture is leading us in different directions and in kind of tendencies in culture, that the way culture sees life really does tend to frame how we view life. I can't say it's all right or good, but it's often the case. What does culture say? Culture says walk away from broken things. Culture says walk away from a spouse that doesn't meet your needs. Culture says, kids, just hold on until you're 18, because at that point you can get away from and out from under your crazy parents. Culture says a lot of things, and many of them run completely against the very things that God is calling us to. Run completely against God's heart in a fallen world. And so at every moment, is this what God is showing me, or is this a cultural tendency that I'm being drawn towards? Do you see how creation, fall, redemption starts to give us a lens to start to view and to call things counterfeits that we think we just are going to go along with? We must put the lenses that God has given to us, we must put them on, because it gives us a new way of seeing. What do we start to see? That the lens of the gospel, we typically think of the gospel this way, that it's just a transactional thing. I go to Billy Graham conference, he does the altar call, I walk down, I give my life to Jesus, and that's the gospel. That is definitely an aspect of the gospel, that we respond to the call of God. Is that the full extent of the gospel? In no way, shape, or form. The gospel is not just a transactional thing or a one-time event that you came to Christ back maybe 20 or 30 or 1 year ago. It is something that the gospel has import today. That the gospel is a path that we walk daily, not simply a truth that we believe. And this is where the story of redemption starts to give us a path to walk. That the path of the gospel is death leading to life. It is suffering leading to glory. It is creation, fall, redemption, and fulfillment. That if you want to know Jesus in a deeper way, you walk where he walks. And where does Jesus walk? He walks right into the teeth of broken things, and he brings about restoration and healing. If you want to know Jesus, you will follow him into the path of redemption, which is to walk right into the teeth of brokenness. And so that learning to grieve and that movement moves us towards Jesus. Do you hear that? It moves us towards broken things, but because we're not doing that just because out of some, like, you know, sadist kind of version of life, you know, I'm just going to beat myself and flog myself. It's, no, I'm going to walk there because that's where Jesus is. And so this idea of redemption moves us towards Jesus, that all redemption is found in him. So any self-help strategy is only based on your efforts. Any rules for a better marriage or rules for a better church or any things that you do, even biblical things, if it's a list mentality, I do these things and out will pop the life I want, you are the center of redemption, not Jesus. And we are hardwired in America to task lists, right? I have tons of things to do today, and if I don't do them, I just move them tomorrow. And I'm going to do those things, and life is going to work out. And we treat spirituality the same way. If Jesus is not the center of your redemption idea, you are. And that is not biblical. And there really is no healing there. All there is pressure. Redemption is found in the person of Jesus, not the rules of Jesus. The rules flow out. There's no question he tells us how to live. But the rules by themselves will not heal you. The person of Jesus will. And so if you only have a God of rules, then you won't enter into the ache of the world because you know that rules can't fix that. Do you hear that? So if you have a God of rules only, you will not enter into broken things because you know the limit of the God that you have. Bottom line, if your hope for healing or restoration doesn't lead you to Jesus, then you have a misplaced hope. And finding Jesus leads us into areas of brokenness. And so this idea, creation, fall, redemption, fulfillment, really has import for all areas of life. It's not just like 9:30 to 10:45 when we sit here. That's not just like the churchy thing to talk about. This is a lens that we can lay over everything. So here's four questions to ask. I wish we had PowerPoint, but we don't. Okay, here's four questions to ask for when we start to think through creation, okay? What was God's created design? And I'm saying think of a specific area of life. We're going to talk about marriage. We're going to talk about family. We're going to talk about work. We're going to infer on some others. Think of an area of life. What is God's created design for that area? Sometimes it's not completely obvious. You might have to really search scripture. What does God intend for this? And then the next question is, how has this area been corrupted by sin and its effects? Okay, so how has God made it good and right and beautiful? How has sin and its effects started to corrupt these things? And it might just be things are broken, but then even better, how do you respond in a broken manner to the thing that was once designed very good? We're going to get into that. So it's not just the brokenness of the area itself, it's how we respond now to that area of life that is also part of the broken and affected things of this world. So how is it broken? The next question, how can Jesus heal this corruption? How can he restore? Last question, what do we long? What do we long for that would be made glorious once again? You know, that last idea of ultimate hope. So how was it created? How is it broken? How can Jesus restore? And what do we ultimately long for? Do you hear that? Creation, fall, redemption, fulfillment or consummation. So it applies to all areas of life. Let's take the area of marriage. And so you're saying, okay, I'm not married. I can check out now. Please don't. Because what we understand about marriage in many ways mirrors every relationship in your life. So if you're single, single again, young, wherever you are on this continuum, please don't check out. Because our understanding of marriage really is a microcosm of all relationships. Here's the thing. If you're single, you may be married one day. If you're young, you want to be married one day. Or, say, you know what, I don't want to be married again. You have friends that are married. And you need to encourage them in the way of the gospel. And so all of these things, and maybe even God would heal your heart through his gospel through this. So please, if this is not your scenario, please don't check out, because these principles apply to all aspects. We're just applying it in one specific area. That how did God create this? How did God create the area of marriage? It was very good. It was not good for man to be alone, and he gave him a wife, Eve. They were fully known. Okay, you flip over to Genesis chapter 2. We're going to be doing a lot of back and forth between Romans 8 and Genesis 2 and 3. What does it say? That he gives Adam a wife, Genesis chapter 2, in verse 23, how does Adam respond? You could say, just to be somewhat funny, he was pretty excited about this idea. This, at last, is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She will be called woman because she was taken out of man. What does it say? 24, therefore a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. The idea of marriage out of family. You might be thinking, there were not even other people on the planet, just Adam and Eve. How is he talking about families? Because this is part in the fabric of who we are as people. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother, be united to his wife, hold fast to his wife. The idea of marriage. What does it say in the next verse? Verse 25. And the man and his wife were both naked and were not ashamed. How was marriage originally created? It was that we would be fully known, that we would be without shame, that we would be one flesh, that we would be together without hiding, without second guessing, without distrust. Okay, that's how God created marriage. So how does the fall enter into the realm of marriage? What shows up in marriage because of the fall? If they were naked and felt no shame, what shows up in large measure in marriage is the aspect of shame. And shame shows itself by what? Hiding. Look at Genesis chapter 3, you know, they go their own way, and what do they immediately do is they hide. Why? Because shame shows itself up in hiding. We're going to unpack these things. But also, the created design is that they would leave their father and mother and be united together and become one flesh. And so what's the broken things in show up? How does the fall show up? How does brokenness show up in marriage? Is to negate the one flesh union. And all of a sudden, there is distance in marriage that never was before. So the idea of shame and hiding, a lacking of oneness leading to distance. What is it to be shame? Let's kind of unpack those things. What is shame? It's basically shown by hiding, you know, that it's the traumatic exposure of nakedness. put it a little bit more close to home, the sense of being known and being seen and then feeling deficient or like a fool. That's shame. You know, psychologically or physically, emotionally, basically holding back in any way, shape, or form, kind of covering and hiding all of the different facets of your being. Maybe in your relationships, you know, think of these things that you might cover in some way. Your opinions, your fears, your joys, the things you celebrate, or maybe even your desires. Do you feel absolutely and completely and utterly free in all four of those, in speaking all four of those things in your marriage? I would highly doubt it. Why? Because the aspect of shame, those are imports into our heart, and we cover and we hide and we conceal. Now, some people would say, well, that's because I live with someone I don't trust. They've responded in ways that are not good, and therefore I hide myself. I will grant that not every marriage partner is a wonderful beauty in that regard. But let's not fool ourselves from something. We are naturally hardwired because of the fall of mankind to hide and conceal and not let people deeply into our heart. Even without the response of the other, you might have the most perfect spouse on the other end and you're still going to conceal and hide. Why? Because to be fully known is something that the human heart does not want to do. And so it shows up in so many ways. So let's just kind of take a look into that. You know, no speaking, not speaking what we're truly thinking. Has that ever happened to anyone this week? You had a thought and you didn't speak it. Okay? You might be because of the other person, or you might say, you know what, I'm kind of ashamed of that thought that popped into my head. I'm not sure how if I'll get judged or critiqued for it. What about this? Not speaking what you really need in marriage. What about resisting intimacy in marriage? There's so many ways that shame starts to show up. Think of the things in recent history that you've not spoken. You know, especially the things that you wanted or needed. Kind of start to unpack those a little bit. You were reluctant to share them. You know, you don't want to be in need. You don't want somebody to see the desires that you really have, even your spouse, because desire shows something. It shows something very, very deep inside. So if I talk about my deep desires, you have an import into my heart. Think of the person that's unwilling to show enjoyment. You know that person? The person that kind of is stoic all the time and is unwilling to really enjoy something? That's really a form of hiding, not wanting people to see deeply into our inner world. And all of that says we're not free. We guard our words. We hold back. We are for fear of being known, fear of being rejected, fear of putting ourselves out there, fear of being mocked and scoffed at your thoughts. And all of this profoundly shows up, make you uncomfortable, in the realm of intimacy and specifically in the bedroom. And what just happened in you right now is the aspect of shame. When you got real still or put your head down, you're like, I'm not going to move so nobody notices me. The sense when we talk about sexuality and intimacy, that thing, that feeling that goes up your back and kind of like, ooh. When you kind of freeze and don't want to be seen or known in that moment, is the aspect of shame and hiding played out in one specific conversation? And the thing is, it enters into our marriages. Shame and hiding enter there because it is the broken thing of this world. I can't tell you the number of couples I've met with that seem great just walking around here, maybe even in life, the Little League field, at school, all these different things. But the aspect of hiding and shame in their realm of intimacy is staggering. The reality of the fall in marriage is absolutely, absolutely real and incredibly huge. Think of it this way, especially if you're a young high school or college student. Why does pornography have such a stronghold on people? Why does it have such a stronghold? Because it offers pleasure, and this pleasure of sexuality, without the need to be known. Think of those two things. The pleasure and the satisfaction of sexuality without the need to be known. Yet, its destructive power is right there, that sex was never designed to be an anonymous experience. Single men and women, students, why not look at porn? Because you are learning an approach to sexuality that is outside of relationship. Basically, pleasure and satisfaction without one, without a relationship. Now, fast forward that 2 decades or a decade or whenever to being married, there is a real person that you must interact with. One that you must consider, one that doesn't respond to your every desire or command, one that must work to understand, that you must work to understand and work to care for. And all of a sudden you realize that sex in marriage requires that you not think primarily of yourself, but yet you have laid patterns of sexuality that said it's all about you and it has nothing to do with a relationship. And that sex is more about enjoying a person than an experience. But yet you've experienced the exact opposite for years. Do you see how the idea of marriage and the fall starts to then influence? It was created good. How is it broken? Honestly, I could go on all day about how marriage is broken. Kind of had to just stop. It's broken in so many ways, and we lead ourselves there over years. And students, I'm not making this up. You want to have a hard conversation? Ask your parents. That we bring broken patterns in, and the reality of the fall is there. But does it end there? So there's that idea of shame. There's the idea of one. What does that lead to? Is a complete breakdown in oneness. The two will become one flesh. You ever look back at your wedding vows? You know, that's not always easy. I'll read some to you. I just did a wedding. I do promise and covenant before God and these witnesses to be your loving and faithful husband, in plenty and in want, in joy and in sorrow, in sickness and in health, as long as we both shall live. But once your husband or your wife starts to be really annoying, and then really annoying over and over and over again, we act like the exact opposite of the loving and faithful husband. Actually, we find ourselves moving away from them, and they're the one that we cherished to the highest extent at one point. We feel the frustration of their unique personality or maybe their sin, and rather than being in the fight with them, what do? We wall ourselves off from them and that part of them, and we start to distance ourselves. Do you hear how these things are starting to show up, the broken things of this world? I did it this morning. I mean, really, I'm writing a sermon on this. At least it should be on the forefront of my mind. You know, I'm getting ready early. I was kind of doing a different schedule. She woke up, and she said something, and I'm like, it didn't make any sense for what I was working on. And I kind of looked at her, and I was like, I just kind of shook my head, and I walked out of the room. What went on in my mind? She did something that annoyed me. Rather than moving towards her in the broken thing, what did I do? My heart wanted to distance myself from her. Do you see how the fall affects the oneness, the good creation of God? I did it this morning, not even 2-3 hours ago. And so when we look at these things, then we start to see, all right, God, how will you redeem? How will you show up in this thing? How will you start to heal and restore? It's that we see redemption show up in our marriage. It's the groaning and the aching of what is broken. Now, marriage is broken in a lot of ways. Your response to those broken things is part of the problem. My response to the broken things is part of the problem. That I would actually groan over the broken things in my relationship with Linda. That I would ache over those things. And when I groan and I ache and I think, all right, and then I'm longing for something to get better, and then I realize there's no checklist that I can put together to fix our marriage. None. Where does that lead me? It leads me to Jesus. Because I realize that what I am groaning about and aching about, I cannot fix. And once you get there, you have just begun the life of faith. And so I welcome you to look honestly at the broken things in any area. We're talking about marriage. I feel like we're running out of time to do family and work and all these others. To honestly look at the brokenness of those things. Ache and groan over them. Long for Jesus to restore, because you cannot fix it in and of yourself. That we ought to respond in dependence upon him, in sheer crying out the psalmist. How long, O Lord, for him to come and restore? And what does he do? All of a sudden, he starts to change your heart. And your marriage, all of a sudden, starts to be restored. And nothing has changed situationally. But he's changed your heart towards your spouse. Just in the very longing and groaning for God to come in and fix, rather than you be in charge of your marriage. Does that make sense? Redemption leads you to Jesus. And I would say walk right into the broken things of your relationship. Allow them to heal rather than to overlay them with good things. In the sense that, you know, you could see a train wreck happening in your marriage. And you say, you know what? We're going to have a date night. We're going to have a date night every week because that's going to fix this without ever talking about it. That's called denial. That's not the gospel. The gospel says, I'm going to walk right into the teeth of this mess. And who did that in our home is Linda for me. Not even 3-4 weeks ago, she's like, we need to talk. We need to sit down and have one of those hard talks that might end up in us not talking for a little while. You know what I'm talking about. And we need to have it. And so that's Monday morning, because I'm off on Mondays. And so we took the girls to school. We came back. We had breakfast together. And we sat down. And 3 hours later, we got to the point, because God was gracious enough to say, all right, we're going to speak into the broken things of our marriage. We are not going to deny them. We're not going to ignore them. We are going to call them what they are. And we're going to ask Jesus to heal. We got to the point of saying, you know what, we should probably stop talking before we mess this up. Been there? And the rest of the week was amazing as God started to restore and heal. But the only way to do that is to walk right into the teeth of broken things and plead that God would heal them. Because shame starts to show up. And what is shame? You know, the things you feel that you're hiding and trying to cover, all those are things that you need healing in. So rather than try to hide those things, walk right into them and invite your spouse into it. What are the inhibitions you have? What are the things you're not sharing? Why are you not sharing them? Because like I told this couple, Will and Sean, over the weekend, the marriage is a reenactment of the gospel. That sounds great until you look at what the gospel is. They read a passage from Colossians, or had one of their moms read it, that it talked about having compassionate hearts, having humility, patience, bearing with one another, forgiving, putting on love. Those sound great and glorious until you realize all of those things are necessitated by frustration in someone else, or their sin showing up in your life, or their hurt now becoming your burden. Think about it. Compassion. You need compassion when somebody else is hurting, many times because of your doing. Humility is not thinking that you're better than them because they haven't figured it out. Patience, that the other has taken a long time to change. Bearing with each other, that someone's lack of planning has moved from really cute to really annoying. Forgiving one another as Christ forgave you. The other has wronged you and you forgive them. And putting on love, that you have to actually make a conscious effort to love and to put that on towards other people. And I told him, I said, this is not the Cinderella story that you live happily ever after. It is the story of redemption played out day to day in your home. That a healthy marriage does not live in denial of each other's shortcomings. It looks straight into the broken, ugly traits of each other. Calls it for what they are, but still lives in hope that God will heal and restore. That's the movement of the gospel. In marriage, in friendship, in family, in work, in every aspect of life. And uniquely, you are called, if you're married or if you're in a deep friendship, to foster that growth in the other thing. Redemption moves us towards Jesus, because that is not a natural move. The natural move says, I'm going to move away from broken things. The move of the gospel moves us towards brokenness, and there we find Jesus, because we are in desperate need of him. Where's the healing for shame and for hiding? It's found in Jesus as well. What does it say in Hebrews chapter 12? Kurt preached it last week. It says in verse 2, that looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him, he endured the cross. And what did he do? Endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. That Jesus heals shame and heals us by walking into, like he shames shame, so to speak. He walks right into the teeth of it so that healing can come about. I would pray that we are a people that don't just see broken things, annoyance, frustration, sin, all of that, and just say, you know what, I'm walking away. When we do that, we will not find Jesus. When we do that, we are really denying the truth and reality of this world. When we do that, our relationships will not heal. They might look better on the outside, but I promise you they're not healing. Healing comes when we walk into the fall to then see Jesus be the Redeemer. And that leaves us in a place of utter desperation, which is a beautiful place for God's people to be, because it's not about you. You can't fix it. Jesus is the one that we find in the middle of our struggle. I want to welcome you to find him in all areas of life. Maybe next week we'll pick up family, pick up work, pick up the rest of the world, and see how this paradigm starts to lead us in other areas. So let's pray.